Speaking on this program is Chris Perry.
Unity in the home. I dare say in a group like this, there are some homes here that are disjointed. You know, and you think about that, and you hear that, and you automatically assume we're talking about divorce. And of course, divorce divides homes. There cannot be unity in any way when divorce enters in. We understand that. But there are a whole lot of families that are not divorced, but are disjointed, where there is disunion in those homes. And it might even be said that there are times in many of our lives as husbands and wives and mothers and fathers and sons and daughters where we experience disunion. And that's a little bit about, that's along the lines of what I would like to talk about this evening. My topic that was assigned to me is unity in the home, and it's vitally important because the home is the building block of everything else. Brother Tony Lawrence prayed for our nation, building block of our nation, each individual home. This congregation, made up of individual homes and families. And so it's vitally important that we talk about this issue, and that's what we're going to do this evening. And we're really going to focus on three really simple points. Number one, disunion in the home. And we're going to look at some Old Testament examples of disunion in the home, and what we'll notice is nothing good ever came from it. And then we'll notice an example or two of unity, but it's not unity based on good things, and what union for evil does inside the home. And then we'll talk about union, that is unity in the home, that is true unity. And we'll try to talk about those things as we go through tonight. First of all, disunion in the home. It doesn't take very long if you're going through the Old Testament to find an instance of disunion in the home. In Genesis chapter 16, you'll remember that Sarah comes to Abraham and they have a discussion. It says in verse 1, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said unto Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of his wife." Now, I don't know exactly how this transpired, but here's what I have envisioned in my head. And I take this from Genesis chapter 15. Because you see, in Genesis chapter 15, God had discussed with Abraham all of the good things that would come through his seed. And he talked about how that nation would be taken into captivity in Egypt, but there it would grow. It would incubate. And eventually it would be that great and wonderful nation that was promised in Genesis chapter 12. So I am convinced that in Genesis 16, Abraham knew that God was going to give him a child. But here comes Sarah. And having the relationship that every good husband and wife does, the wife started to convince her husband. I don't know if this is all of the conversation we have, but what I see here is a disjointed home. We have a husband who had been talking directly with God. That patriarchal age allowed for such. But you had a wife who was not on the same page as Abraham, who didn't fall in line with what God had told Abraham. And because of that, there was sin. It's interesting that a lot that is dealt with in history has some of its roots here in the pages of the book of Genesis. You see in Genesis 16, but it doesn't take much to go very farther to find it again. In Genesis chapter 19, once again, we're introduced to some disunion. Lot, if you remember, had pitched his tent towards Sodom, and that was the beginning of the end for his godly family. And despite Abraham's intervention, there was not enough righteous found in those wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so they flee by God's direction from that city, but again, they're not on the same page. And Lot knows that he is to not look back, that he is to keep his eyes focused in front of him, but his wife looked back and became a pillar of salt. Nothing good ever comes from disunion. Well, then you continue throughout the Old Testament and you see over and over again the same thing. Job is probably one of the most horrific cases of that. I love my wife and she is my friend. And, you know, we'll get into this in a little bit. And of course, this sermon isn't about me, but I think it was just last night or the night before that Danielle was talking to me about something, and she needed me to listen to something, and as we husbands sometimes are, I wasn't in the mood to listen. And I said, why do we need to talk about this right now? And you know what she said? Because you're my friend. And she was absolutely right. Imagine being in the most destitute circumstance you could ever be in. Imagine being, for all intents and purposes, completely and totally alone. And you need someone there. And so you look to your wife. Isn't that what I would have done in Job's circumstances? I would have looked to my wife. But what did his wife say? Curse God and die. But why in the world, Job, would you bother doing this? Would you bother going through all of this? Just give up a disjointed marriage. And that certainly didn't help Job. And we see it over and over again throughout the Old and New Testaments. But the first example I thought about in the Old Testament is in 1 Samuel chapter 25. And we don't have time to go through that whole context. But you remember there was a man by the name of Nabal. And you remember that Nabal was a wealthy man, a man that had all sorts of flocks and all sorts of land and all sorts of food at his disposal. And David was on the run, and David needed some assistance. And I want you to keep in mind that this was an Oriental society, a nomadic society, where they depended upon the hospitality of others. It was a staple of their society and their culture. And so David sent servants out to Nabal, and he said, "Can you please help us?" And Nabal, in essence, said, "Who in the world is David, and who is the son of Jesse?" He said, "For all I know, all of these servants are just rebels and rogues come from their master and coming with these lies." As the story progresses, Abigail has to fix the mistakes of Nabal on a number of occasions. Eventually, it leads to Nabal's demise. But it's very interesting. There's one instance where Abigail had to say, "His name is Nabal." And as his name is, it means literally fool, by the way, as his name is, so is he. Nothing worse than a disjointed relationship. A beautiful, lovely, godly, wise woman married to a man who could only live up to his name that meant fool. And we see time and time again in the Old Testament how this always brings about difficulty. There are, if you will, three layers to this disunion. Disunion that takes place in marriages, disunion that takes place in the home, usually exists in three layers. And the first is the husband-wife layer. Disunion. And I'll submit to you that this disunion starts way before marriage. Way before marriage. I'm not sure how many young people we have here this evening, but we've got enough for me to say this. Be very careful who you choose to marry. Be very careful. It might very well be the case that you pave the path to disunion long before you ever tie the knot. My son Jordan obeyed the gospel not too long ago. And I remember we were behind the baptistry just about to perform the baptism. And if you know my son, you know he despises the thought of marriage. Not marriage in general, just him engaging in the act of marriage. And I said, "Jordan, you know this is one of the two greatest decisions you'll ever make in your life. You know what the second one is? Who you choose to marry. It's vitally important." Every time I get a chance to talk about marriage to young people and to old alike, I bring up this point. Be careful who you date. You so often we have this idea that opposites attract. And in many cases, that's true. In fact, there was an article in the Journal of American Psychology, and it was proven to be accurate by some folks at MIT. And essentially what this study showed was marriages work out better with wives who are more attractive than their husbands. Now, that's not a joke. That's the truth. Now, as I look out here, I see a lot of really good marriages. A lot of really good marriages. It's true in some regard that opposites attract. When it comes to physical appearance, maybe. When it comes to interests and hobbies, maybe that's the case. When it comes to personality, that might be the case. But young people, don't ever give in to the notion that opposite should attract when it comes to the most staple and important aspects of your life. Your views on things like religion and family and the way you view the world and the society around you, these are things that ought not be up for debate. Because you and I don't want to find ourselves in positions where, as 2 Corinthians 6:14 says, we are unequally yoked. Now, to me, what that verse means is that you can tie yourself to somebody who can lead you straight. Whether in the business world, whether in marriage, no matter what the circumstance is. And it seems like whenever I say this, I have people who come to me and say, but you don't understand, preacher, my husband and I, he was not a Christian when we married. And I helped to convert him. And I say, that's amazing and that's wonderful. But I don't want my children playing statistics. I don't want my children entering into the second most important decision of their lives with a handicap already. I don't want that. And so I always encourage our young people to begin this process of finding someone who can help you get to heaven long before you ever get married. When we think about those three layers, that husband and wife situation, I'd like you to turn this evening to Ephesians chapter 4. And there are several passages that we're going to look at in Ephesians 4. When they asked me what passage I could read that could be read, I thought about Ephesians 4. When I do premarital counseling, I will take husbands and wives to be to Ephesians chapter 4. Because to me, some of the best teaching on conflict is found in Ephesians 4. And trust me, there will be conflict in every marriage. You know, it's inevitable that I run into a couple that says, we've been married for 65 years and we have never fought. That's what the husband says. And the wife is looking at him like, what in the world are you talking about? Where have you been for 65 years? Now, what kinds of fights they are, that's to be determined. They might be discussions that are very heated and passionate. They might be knockdown dragouts. I don't know. But conflict arises in a relationship of any type. How do you deal with that conflict? Will there be disunion in that relationship? Verse 25 beginning, wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Every relationship, and I do mean every relationship, must be based on honesty. Where there is lying and dishonesty, there will be disunion. It is inevitable. Satan is the father of lies, and what's his specialty?
Division.
How do you create division with lies? And yet I talk to young ladies all of the time who are dating a man who's lying to her, and she knows it. And she says, but he'll change. I talk to a young man who says, well, this young lady, I know she's lying to me. I know she's doing things that she ought not, and she's not being honest about them, but she'll change. Relationships must be based on honesty. Verse 26, be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. There will be conflict. How you deal with it is what matters. Are you going to allow conflict and disagreement to become disunion? That, according to the Apostle Paul, is sin. When disagreement becomes disunion, sin always follows. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Verse 27, neither give place to the devil. Verse 28 seems out of place in this context to many. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. But you know, there's a nugget of good instruction for folks in the midst of disagreements and division. Just work at it. You have husbands that come and say, you know, I want to go to counseling, but my wife doesn't. I want to go to counseling, the wife says, but my husband doesn't. Well, you keep coming. You labor. You work with your hands that which is good. The best way to overcome sin is to work as hard as you can. And sometimes, just sometimes, if you work as hard as you can, they'll get the idea. Division can be overcome. Verse 29, isn't this so valuable in our marriages and our homes? Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. You husbands, when's the last time you degraded your wife by the things you said when you were disagreeing? you wives, when's the last time you said something to your husbands in disagreement that brought them down, that discouraged them, that made them feel less than what they should have been? So many times we believe that disagreement gives us license to say whatever we need to in order to win that argument. And I've been guilty of that in my life. Maybe you have as well. But we see here instruction against that, because that prolongs division and disunion between that husband and that wife. Verse 30, grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby you are sealed unto the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, verse 31. Man, that word bitterness, we could camp out on that all evening. I've talked with wives who were bitter to the core at their husbands. Husbands who were so bitter towards their wives. Years of mistreatment, lies, evil communication had built up and had brought about bitterness. But you know what's sad? When I allow the sin of someone else to cause me to sin, and bitterness is just that type of sin, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away with you with all malice. And then this is the golden thread that runs through this context. And be you kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. In that husband and wife relationship, when there is that disunion, you know what the single most powerful tool is to overcome disunion? It's forgiveness and kindness. Within the church, what is the single greatest tool to overcome division that is not doctrinal? And make no mistake about it, in many congregations, it is not doctrine that causes division. It is people. How do you overcome that? Kindness and forgiveness. That's how we do it. Be kind to one another. Tenderhearted. Forgiving one another. But then we move to this second layer. We've been that husband and wife, and we have those children. And then you see these people who are so in love turn on each other. I've seen parents who tried to outdo each other with their children. Heard of an instance where I actually saw this with my own two eyes. There was a young boy riding a zero-turn mower. My wife loves our zero-turn mower. I enjoy our zero-turn mower. My son's not old enough to get on a zero-turn mower. That's my opinion. You guys might have yours out. I know some of y'all started probably driving tractors when you were 4 or 5. I understand that. I didn't come from there, and that's okay too. But I think it's a little young, and this fella's mother thought he was a little young too, and had said, this son, he doesn't need to be on a zero-turn mower. Every time the mother left, the daddy put him on a zero-turn mower. And I thought, you know, this isn't right. If they can't agree on how to be parents, what's that going to do to that household? You see, disunion within the home can cause all sorts of problems. In Titus 2 and verse 4, those elderly women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands and to love their children. If I love my wife, if she loves me, we will be on the same page when it comes to those kids. We go back to premarital counseling. What's one of the things we talk about? How do you want to discipline your children? And if you want to see two people really be surprised about what the other one thinks, ask them something like that when they've never dealt with it. I had one fellow say, "We're not having any kids." And she looked at him like, "What in the world are you talking about?" How do you discipline your children? Husbands and wives, parents, mothers and fathers, are you on the same page? Is it truly the case if mama says no, ask daddy? Danielle and I learned long ago that won't work. It just won't work. We have a rule in our household. Mama and daddy tell each other everything. You can't hide that mistake you made from daddy when he wasn't home. When he gets home, mama's going to tell him about it, because that's how we do things in the Perry household. Because there's no disunion when it comes to those parents. That's the way parents are, because they're one flesh after all, aren't they? One flesh. That third layer. Here it comes, parents and children. And oh, we see disunion between parents and children. To the extent that in our culture, what have we said? it's just part of it, right? They're just teenagers. They're supposed to be disunion. Now, I know that children don't always agree with their parents, and I certainly know that parents don't always agree with their children. But it's a two-way street of preventing disunion to the point that it becomes sin. Ephesians 6 and verse 4, you're all familiar with. It says, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." It's interesting how the Bible treats men and women differently in their relationships with each other and their relationships with their children. I'm strict in my household. My wife is strict too. But my wife will very quickly get down on the floor and play with them. Sometimes I feel like I don't do that as much as I should. She's the fun one and I'm the strict one. And that's okay. We get along pretty well. But sometimes she reminds me of Ephesians 6:4. Be careful. Be careful. Sometimes we fathers can place a wedge in between us and our children. And we need to be so very careful of that. And I don't have all the answers. I'm only 37. But I know it's a problem because God told me so. And it's my responsibility to ensure that that does not happen. But Ephesians 6:1 is also there. Ephesians 6:1 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." You see, you children have a part to play in maintaining the unity of that home. How horrible it is to see a godly set of parents have to endure children who have decided they're just not going to listen. And we see it every day. We see it every day. Disunion in the home. Layers of it. And we don't want to see it. But as we continue this evening, there is sometimes unity. But it's unity for the wrong purposes. The greatest example I can think of is in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 5. And it's really a very positive context. This context of Acts 5, where it begins, because in Acts 4, people are laying down fortunes to help those in need. You're even introduced to a man that will play a large role in the future of the church. Acts 4 and verse 36, Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas. He's one who laid down his life savings at the feet of the apostles, and he was willing to give it all. And there was a lot of pressure there, you can tell. And so we're introduced in Acts chapter 5 and verse 1 to a couple, Ananias and Sapphira, his wife. And there are some very interesting things that are said, beginning in verse number 1, "But a certain man named Ananias with Sapphira, his wife." And I think that phrase is very important. With Sapphira, his wife. They were on the same page. They had come together and they had together made this decision to lie to the Holy Spirit. To lie to God about this matter. Now, what was it all about? Everybody was giving everything they had and they didn't want to do that. But they wanted everybody to think they were going to do that. And so they lied and said they gave the whole portion. They wanted to save face. They wanted to keep up with the Joneses. And so they came together and they lied about this and they were unified. In verse 2, he kept back a part of the price, his wife also being privy to it. Man, they were unified. But they weren't unified in the right things. You look at the layers of this union. They were unified financially. They agreed on how to use that money and what to say about it. Because when they come to her, there in Acts chapter 5 and verse 9, Peter said unto her, or verse 8 rather, Peter answered to her, "Tell me whether you sold the land for so much." And she said, "Yay, not for so much." It's obvious that they had come together and they had made this decision. They had come together and were unified in their desire to lie. They were unified, but not in the right things. As well, you see that they were unified socially. You know what they had said? "We want to appear to be something we're not. And we together will work to see that that's accomplished." You know any couples like that? Have you ever been tempted to fall into that category? You know, we've got to put up this facade that we're just like everybody else, that we're as wealthy as this group, or that we're as fun as this group, or that we can do the things that this group does. And there's this pressure to be just like everyone else. But it was, unfortunately, a dishonest union. They lied. They lied. And how is it that these couples, this couple can come together in such a wicked way? I know lots of good couples for whom God is not the center of their life. Couples that in so many other respects are everything you could want a couple to be. And they just lack one thing. God. And you can even sense when you talk to them that they think that their lives are all right. They don't really need God. After all, they're doing okay just the way they are. But there's a fundamental truth that we're missing. And there is a fundamental truth that Ananias and Sapphira were missing. And that is this: if God is not at the center of your marriage, it cannot be the marriage that it needs to be. You cannot reach the plane that you need to reach. But so many times, and especially when we're young, we buy into this idea that if I just have enough stuff, and if I do enough things, and if I do this and that, and go to this and that, then I can be happy as a couple. I can be happy as a family. But unfortunately, you see, that's not the case. Their conspiracy in relationship to money didn't help them at all.
James chapter 3 provides a principle that we would do well to apply to every aspect of life. The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable. You know what that tells me? True unity cannot come without purity. Now that's true in the church when it comes to doctrine. We want to be unified, we want to be one, but we want to forget about all of the doctrinal issues that exist. We can't have true unity while those doctrinal issues exist. It's impossible. The world wants unity and diversity. That's the most ludicrous notion you could ever have. But then you see the same thing working in our homes. I want to have peace, but I don't want to be pure. It can't work that way. It absolutely cannot work that way. Finally, this evening, we see an example of true unity. I wish that we were all like Aquila and Priscilla, and we don't know that much about them. I like to do this exercise because I'm literary minded. I like to fill in the backstories and the gaps in these characters. I like to do that. I wish that Hollywood would become enamored with the stories of the Bible and use them properly. Because there's a whole lot of cinematic, amazing things in here. But they take Noah and they run it into the ground. You know, they take Moses and they run it into the ground. But there's so much here that's worthwhile. And Aquila and Priscilla is one of them. Think about Aquila and Priscilla. We meet them in Acts chapter 18. And to me, it's one of the most rewarding studies. Verse 1 says, "After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife, Priscilla." Now, there's different opinions as to whether these people were Christians when Paul met them here or whether they were Jews and he converted them. And I can't answer that question because there are things we just don't know about Aquila and Priscilla. But I know it doesn't take long for them to be really devout. Whatever the circumstances that surrounded their conversion, they were soon very devout. Acts 18 and verse 18 says, "And Paul after this tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren and sailed thence into Syria, and with him," and I want you to notice this, it's subtle, but it's amazing, "with him Priscilla and Aquila." If you know anything about the culture of the day, what was the status of a woman in these times? Even at this point, they were second-class citizens. They didn't have a whole lot of rights. It was certainly not customary for the wife's name to come first. And yet we see Priscilla and Aquila. And that to me is very interesting. But it's also interesting that Paul thought good, well enough of them to take them with him. That says something about their character. But then we continue. In Acts 18 and verse 26, We have a man here named Apollos who is very eloquent and very bold, but he is mistaken. Now, it's an honest mistake. He doesn't know that what he's teaching is error. And I wish we had more people who just didn't know what they were teaching was error, and we could talk to them about it, and we could show them the error of their ways, and they would repent, and it would be great. Unfortunately, we have a great number of people who know what they're teaching is not what it ought to be, and they do it anyway. But in verse 26, and he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. Man, you've got a husband and wife who are so dedicated to God and each other that they do these things together. They're mentioned throughout the rest of the New Testament. I've got some of the references up there for you. We won't take time to notice them. But again, on occasion, it's mentioned Priscilla and Aquila. She was held in just as high regard as he was. You know, we've got some great preachers in the brotherhood, but you know what else we've got? Some wonderful preachers' wives. Mine included. There are a whole lot of wives who didn't sign on to be preachers' wives. Did you know that? And it's not a job to be taken lightly. Priscilla and Aquila were unified in their love for God and their dedication to the truth. There are layers to their union. It was indeed a financial union. Now, I might step on some toes here, and I guess that's my job, so we'll allow it. Can we really be unified if we have a his and her checking account? If my money goes here and hers goes there? I've wondered that. I talk with couples in premarital counseling, and that's one of the things we talk about, finances. How can we be one flesh and have separate checking accounts? You know, I haven't taken Danielle out to dinner in years. Not done it. Because I don't know whose money's paying for that dinner. Is it mine or hers? For all I know, she's taking me out to dinner. Because it's all the same place. It's all coming from the same place. Now, some couple will come to me and say, we've made it 50 years and we've done just fine. And I applaud you, to each his or her own. I understand that. But there's a principle there, I believe, of unity. You know, I'm not going to go buy a bass boat and not tell my wife about it. We just bought us a new car. It's new to us. It's not new. Danielle always wants me to make that clear. It's new to us. And we went to the dealership. I went to the dealership. Danielle told me to. You go and you talk numbers. Okay, so I sat down and I talk numbers. I'm not a good negotiator. Maybe it's, I don't have the booming voice that Robert Jeffries has, and you know, he looks like he's 8 years older than me, and I'm older than him. I got birth certificates to prove it. And we can talk about that later. So I sit down, and I think it's a fair price what I negotiated, and I call my wife, and she says, I don't like that. And I'd already told this fellow, you know, I'm not going to sign a single paper until my wife's sitting beside me. Because it's not just my decision. Because it's not just my money. Aquila and Priscilla were financially joined. You know how I know that? They were tent makers. They. Could you handle working with your spouse? Some of you may. I went to the Memphis School of Preaching, and my wife was the secretary there our first year of marriage. You want to talk about trying a marriage? Be around each other 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When you're first married. You think it'd be great. And it was, for the most part. They were financially joined. But number two, there was a social union. Find me an instance where they're mentioned separately. I challenge you to. You can't. And don't you know those couples where you can't just mention one of them? When you mention one of their names, you have to mention the other one. Because they're that unified. And whenever one is doing something, the other one is. I preached a meeting in Fulton, Mississippi, and there was this couple, and how long they'd been married? 60 plus years. Had never spent a night apart. He had tried to leave for one night, and she got so scared and upset, he came back. You talk about union. You talk about togetherness. That social union. Everybody knew them as one unit. And of course, that one unit operated in the sphere of religion. They shared their faith. If you don't know what it's like to share a faith with the one that you love the most on this earth, you're missing out on one of the single greatest blessings that this life can offer you. And Aquila and Priscilla knew that blessing. They knew what it was like to be unified, to be one flesh in service to God. Unity in the home. This congregation will live and die according to the families that make it up. You know, and it might not be as apparent in a large congregation like Central and others that we have here. Just take a journey out to some of the county congregations. Some of them maybe are hanging on by a thread. You know why? Three or four families left the church, had disagreements, division, disjointed. Does that mean it's time for me to stop? That's a very strange way to tell me it's over with. It happens to the best of us. I tell you it does. But you don't have to travel far to see the consequences of losing families. And what we need to understand here this evening is that you and I represent one stone in the building that is the church that belongs to Christ. And it matters how our families operate behind closed doors. It matters how unified or disjoined we are. And I know that every one of you likely has fussed and fought all the way to the church building, and then the moment you touch that door, it's all smiles and roses. But what you did from the driveway to the parking lot matters just as much as what you do when you're in these pews. It matters to the church. It matters to the country. It matters to your children. It matters to their future spouses and their future children. When disunion comes in and it breaks up a family, whether visibly or not, nothing good ever comes from it. So I challenge us this evening. Let's place our families at a higher standard. Let's really challenge ourselves. Get rid of that disunion. Let's work on disagreeing in a godly way. Let's work on being unified with God as our center. And let's see if this congregation and the Lord's church, wherever it goes, let's see if it doesn't just bust through the doors. Because as the family goes, so goes the church. As the family goes, so goes the country. And as this family goes, so goes the world. But did you know that each family is also made up of individuals? And you and I help to determine what our families are like. It may be the case that there is a father or a mother, a husband or a wife, a son or a daughter, who knows exactly what they need to do, and you've just never done it. Do you know the impact that you can have on your family? I've seen fathers who resisted for years and years and years, and they finally obey the gospel, and it's amazing what happens in that family. It's amazing what happens in the church. That man who everybody knows, or that woman that everybody knows, they need to do that, and when they do it, man, it's amazing. Have you never obeyed the gospel this evening? You are a building block in a family, and thus a church, and a country, and a world. Put Christ on in baptism, having believed in Him, repented of your sins, and had the courage to confess His name before witnesses. Make that decision this evening. Romans 6, 3 and 4 reminds us that we put that old man of sin and we bury it in that watery grave, and we are raised to walk in newness of life. But dear Christian, is there disunion in your family, in your home? Congregation, is there disunion within the walls of this congregation? If so, let's get it out.